This is Indigo Radio, deepening understanding and making connections.
قبل ناس قلوبها مش نظيفة تحاول تحسسك انها اعلى منك واذا هي بتفكر هيك يعني هي اوطى منك انت مش ارهاب انت مش حيوان انت انسان اللي مخرب اسمك اشي اسمه سياسة تاخد المنح منك لانها طمانة في ناس معك ماشي لانها حزانة العربي المسكين بتكاش هالمساعدة كلمة مسكين طلعها من راسك المسكين بسكت انت احكي اللي بحساسك تسحيش فيش فيها عيب احنا وقعنا انت واقف عجريك احنا بكينا انت امسح دموعنا يا لحمي ودمي ارفعوا لنا روسنا.
This is Anna out of Atlanta for Indigo Radio. Indigo Radio is a project of the Spark Teacher Education Institute based out of Southern Vermont. We are a group of educators seeking to learn through engaging with others in our community and throughout the world. Find us at indigo.radio on Instagram and Facebook, and you can also download a previous show on SoundCloud and Apple iTunes. Indigo is now broadcasting out of Southern Vermont, Western Mass, Atlanta, Seattle, and Morocco. Today's show is with two Emory undergraduate students, Zach and Bella. I sat down with them last week as they are the leadership team of Students for Socialism at Emory. I sat down to talk with them about what has influenced their own political thought, organizing at Emory, the role of the media, and much more. Thanks for tuning in today, and thanks for Bella and Zach for joining us on Indigo Radio. Bella and Zach, thank you so much for joining Indigo Radio today. I would love to start with you each introducing yourself, and why don't you tell us what you're studying at Emory? Also, however you'd like to introduce yourself, so that if there's other information that you'd like us to know, then go for it.
Hi, I'm Bella. I am a senior at Emory University. I study business, specifically marketing and political science. I am with the PSL and with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, as well as one of the main organizers for Students for Socialism at Emory.
My name's Zach. I'm a junior at Emory, and I'm studying, this is kind of a mouthful, but I'm studying math and computer science as my first major, and then philosophy, politics, and law as my second major. Like Bella, I pretty recently joined the Party for Socialism and Liberation just this past November. And with Bella, we are the co-presidents and currently the entire leadership of Students for Socialism, which is a new club at Emory.
Yeah, so let's start there, actually. Why don't you tell us about what Students for Socialism at Emory is? And also, if you could, in that, what was the impetus for starting it?
So Students for Socialism is an organization that occurs at universities. It is affiliated with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, but basically it's an organization to get college students more familiar with Marxist theory, as well as helping students gain the skills to organize. and know how to eventually, when they graduate, know how to organize their workplaces, know how to organize their where they live, tenant unions, that sort of thing. So basically preparing students for when they get out of college, how to organize and better advocate for themselves.
Yeah, and to add to that answer a little bit, Students for Socialism, like some of the things that we're trying to do that set us apart from other organizations on campus and that make us unique is that unlike a lot of other student organizations, we are the affiliate of like a national organization. So we have like a predetermined political line among the students in Students for Socialism. We're not like debating things or coming up with our own ideas as it comes to these things, which maybe might sound a little bad, but I've seen in the past has been a huge issue for a lot of other student organizations, which can get really bogged down in things like details. And another thing that we really hope will set us apart is that we're trying to do a lot. Like, we're not really trying to ever have a week off or a week where we don't do something. We're trying to be a place where students can consistently come to organize and know we'll always have more going on.
Okay, thanks for that. I did not realize that it was connected to PSL. So one thing I would like one of you to do too is just, can you explain PSL for people that may not know what PSL is?
Sure, I can give like a brief rundown. So the Party for Socialism and Liberation was established during the Iraq War. I believe it was in 2004. And it was founded out of the premise that the United States really does not have a strong socialist organization. And so the founders wanted to create an organization that could really grow but also still have one coherent voice and one coherent political ideology or like goal, right? And so the PSL has a national organization, of course, it has like a national representation, but there are branches across the country. There's over like 130 branches across the United States. For us and our work for Students for Socialism, you know, the Atlanta branch obviously was the one that was helping us out. The PSL has engaged in many, many struggles, including anti-war struggles in the past, or the struggle for Black lives and abortion and other issues as well. But right now, you know, a lot of our attention has been on the Palestinian struggle.
Yeah, I want to add to that a little bit. Like Bella said, the PSL was formed out of the anti-Iraq war movement. And so it sort of is and also formed out of the ANSWER Coalition, which is Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. And so it is has a very strong focus on anti-imperialism, which I think is incredibly important, just because I'm a strong believer that like much of history has been the history of, or, you know, recent histories, but the history of colonialism and anti-colonialism, imperialism and anti-imperialism, sort of these international struggles. But another thing that Bella said that like really draws me to the PSL is that like it's not ignoring specific issues. Like, it is paying attention to the abortion struggle. Like, it's a feminist organization. It's paying attention to the Palestine struggle. It's an anti-imperialist organization. Like, it's paying attention to the struggle against police violence. It's like they care about women, race, class, empire, all of the things. Yeah.
Zach, you mentioned that there is a predetermined political line, is what you said. Could you describe to us what that political line is?
Yeah. So one of the main things that comes to mind when I think of this is that like the PSL's line on Palestine, for example. So of course the PSL has like a line on most things. Like, there's a party line and they've debated topics and come up with a Marxist opinion on things. An example of like the party line in action and like why that's so important is that like the PSL had already figured out its stance on Palestine on October 6th. And so on when October 7th, the attacks occurred, by October 8th, PSL National was able to send out communicate with every branch and be like, we need to start doing Palestine actions. Like, need to start organizing for Palestine. And so while a lot of other organizations were like debating what they should do, whether they should like sort of both sides it or side with the Palestinian resistance, et cetera, the PSL already sort of they knew what they wanted to do, and every branch acted with like a unified voice and said, free Palestine.
Bella, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The party line is obviously it hits on so many issues that we could go on and on just about like the PSL's perspective on like political struggle. You know, recently before October 7th, what the PSL was focused on was on housing rights. They were focused on defending people who had been evicted from their homes, and they were advocating for tenant unions to protect people who are renting from not being kicked out of their homes, which is a big issue for young people who are moving into like big cities. Housing rights is a big issue, but of course that is a more domestic issue, and PSL cares about many domestic issues and stuff, but they also care about anti-imperialism and you know resisting the US war machine.
And I would love to hear from each of you about how you got involved. What led you here?
I have maybe been interested in like radical politics for a lot longer than I should have been before I started organizing. All the way back in high school, I guess, I sort of got interested in like radical politics. When I was in high school, I was like, well, once I go off to college, I'll start becoming an organizer and I'll do all these great things. And then me and Bella both actually spent our first 2 years at Emory out at the Oxford campus, which is Emory's second campus, which is further away. It's about an hour from Atlanta. And there's nothing really going on there. And so there weren't that many opportunities to organize there. And I didn't really do anything. Once I got to Atlanta, I was like, okay, I need to up my game. I need to like start getting organized. And so my sister is actually sort of my communist role model. She's been in the PSL for a couple of years more than me. She's like, you need to get involved. So at the start of the year, I like just started going to PSL events. And then I think I had started to join just before October 7th. And then once that happened, like I was like, this is really important. I need to be there as many weeks as I can. Like I need to be out there every week if I can. And so I would rally. I like started to pick up roles in rallies, you know, like I would marshal or something like that could help out. And through that, I like got a lot more involved with the PSL. I eventually joined in November. I like had intended to sort of get more into student organizing, and I had been sort of involved with student organizing with other organizations that semester. Then this semester, the SFS started going, and now I'm organizing more than ever. Yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Just as Indigo hosts, we're all educators, and we also run this Spark Teacher Training Institute that's run out of Vermont. And so one of the things we're always kind of digging at is how we learn. And so I'm curious if you could tell me, if you go back to high school, because you said that's where it began for you, what was it? Like, what sort of shaped and influenced your thinking? Was there something, if you think back, that pushed you in a certain direction?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up educators, actually, because not in high school, but actually one of my middle school teachers played a really big role in sort of me like changing my perspective on America, or like starting to become question like the official history you're taught in like public schools about America. Because I had this teacher in eighth grade who assigned us a couple of readings from A People's History of the United States. And I believe you've actually mentioned Howard Zinn before, so I'm sure you're familiar. And I read a little bit. I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then I put it on my bookshelf and I didn't return it to school. And then it sat on my shelf for like 2 years. And then right before, I think it was actually a spring break, just like I'm on now, I picked it up off my shelf and I like took it with me on a trip. And I read it over the trip and I was like, wow, this is crazy. The government broke so many strikes and was so anti-worker. I can't believe this. And that sort of like that really blew my mind. And I was like, wow, so much of the history I've like learned in school sanitized so many of these things and like sort of glorified a bunch of things that were in a lot of ways evil. And so I that definitely, you know, it wasn't really like flick the switch. Now I know everything. But then after that, in high school, I guess like on the internet, first I saw just like memes and content like that I was like, oh, that's like really interesting. And then I was like, okay, this is kind of a cesspool. And but like also, you know, people online will be like, oh, read this book, read this book. And I at first I read like some anarchist books and I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then I got into sort of like more Marxist literature and I was like, oh, this is a lot more compelling. I think this is a lot more like a much more complete worldview than anarchism. And I was like, oh, this is super interesting. All through quarantine, I read a ton, I listened to a ton of audiobooks, and I think that's really like how I got educated.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. And Bella, how about you? What led
Well,
you to this type of work?
Yeah, so my political work when I was younger, when I was in high school, it was not focused as much on radical politics. I actually began with electoral politics. That's how I started my journey, and I worked on a local campaign to elect my high school Spanish teacher to the school board. So that was actually how I first started with political work, like on the ground. And I think local representation is definitely super important in general. Would I have wanted to start with that? Probably not, but that's how I started. And I think it gave me a lot of skills that I really use today, which is like, can I go up to a stranger? Because I'm kind of like numb to that, I've done it so many times. I've canvassed hundreds of doors and talked to so many people. And so I'm way more comfortable just like talking to people. And then 2020 happened, COVID, and the way that the government responded to this crisis was definitely super radicalizing for me, as well as the Black Lives Matter uprisings. And I realized, oh, wow, like electoral politics is not going to save us. I should get involved in like organizations that are trying to stop policing or like at least defund the police or whatever. And so I decided to join a local organization back at home where I was at because, we had to go back home during COVID. I decided to join an organization called the Dream Defenders, which was established after the murder of Trayvon Martin. They taught me a lot of things. They taught me about Palestine. I actually first learned about Palestine from Dream Defenders because there were people in the Dream Defenders who were able to go to Gaza. And so I got to talk to people who had went to Gaza and describe the occupation to me. And that caused me to have more questions and then look into like Israel, and I learned about Zionism and stuff like that. So I was already an anti-Zionist before October 7th, right? And so it really taught me on that. And something that definitely also radicalized me and pushed me to be more interested in socialism was definitely visiting Cuba. I got the opportunity to go to Cuba, and this was an academic trip, I guess. It was actually, ironically, it was sponsored by Emory, so I have to thank them for that. It was focused on Spanish literature, but it was wonderful talking to teachers who are revolutionaries and stuff like that. It was an incredible experience, super educational. And though the trip was not intended, the focus of it was obviously not politics. However, it ended up being a radicalizing component for me. I tell this story that like I think always shocks people, but I was uninsured for nearly 2 to 3 years. And when I visited Cuba, I remember like I was waiting at the Atlanta airport. I was just kind of sitting there, and they gave me my plane ticket and had like a stamp on it. And I go up to the flight attendant and I say, "What is this stamp about? Like, what does it mean?" She was like, "Do not lose your ticket." And I was like, "Why?" And she was like, "Because with that stamp, you are authorized to get free healthcare in Cuba. So don't lose it because something happens to you, you need to have it so you can get free healthcare." And I was like, "Wait a minute. I've been uninsured in the United States of America for nearly 2 years now. I've been dealing with mental health crisis. I could not get a therapist. I could not get a psychologist. I was dealing with these problems on my own. But all of a sudden, I went to a small nation, a small island nation 90 miles away from my home state that offered me more kindness than my own country did." So that was when I was like, "Oh, okay, I get it. Like, I get it why. I get why they did this, right?" And so it really all came together for me after that. And I really was like, this country is not taking care of its own people. It engages in endless wars, and it needs to stop. And that's when I was really like, okay, I'm a socialist. When I decided to organize around it, I really didn't know what organizations were even an option. I was really focused on school because like I'm a senior now, and so I have more time to like kind of do other stuff. After October 7th, I saw how The Atlanta PSL reacted to what had happened and the way that they immediately were just like, no, we're in the streets, like we're protesting for in favor of Palestinian freedom. And their steadfastness towards Palestinian emancipation was like, I want to join that. I want to be in that organization. I went to the march to DC on November 4th. I went with the PSL. I took buses up there, and I went again in January as well. I flew up there after spring break. So I've been in the party since January, and it's been one of the best decisions I've made. I'm very happy with it.
Michaela, who hopefully will join us at least maybe for a little bit, we'll see. Right before we all got on, Michaela and I were actually talking about Cuba, and she reminded me of something Fidel Castro once said, in which he said, history will absolve me. And it actually leads to my next question, because I was wondering about, Zach, you had mentioned these words, Marxist worldview. There's, of course, a lot of ways in which that is weaponized and a long history of that in the US in particular. I wonder if you could just put simply how that helps you, that worldview, your own worldview, how you might describe it, and how it helps you stay on what we would consider the right side of history.
Yeah, that sounds great. Bella absolutely loves to say history will absolve me. It's like their favorite thing to say ever. So I was super excited. I know this is an audio format, but I cracked a huge smile when Anna mentioned that. Back to the question about the Marxist worldview. Like, the Marxist worldview kind of helps me. It allows me to sort of see the inherent contradictions between different groups in society. Like, I think the most important contradiction, just like within America, is the contradiction between the owning elite and the working majority. Like, I think in a liberal view, people say like, oh, we can sort of just work together. Like, there are things that benefit some of us, there's things that benefit the other of us, but we should really do, all our policy needs to be a compromise that benefits everyone together. And the Marxist worldview sort of says, this cannot happen. Things are for the working class, or therefore capitalists and owners. And that's why we need to fight for working class thing. We can't be compromising. We can't be like, say, oh, like, take this huge tax cut in exchange for like this, you know, like this working class, pro working class thing. The institutions we have now, things like our government, like Congress, the president, the Marxist worldview recognizes those all as capitalist controlled institutions. It would say that we live currently in what's called a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. And so though we might go to the ballot box and we might write Joe Biden or Donald Trump every 4 years, really both of those people serve the interests of capital. They both do whatever they can to make sure that rich people stay rich and keep getting richer faster, preferably, and make sure that that poor people don't get too uppity, that people don't get too revolutionary and try to overthrow that class system. And sometimes that means concessions. But I think increasingly we've seen that looks more and more like saying you tried to do a good thing or dressing up something you did that wasn't very good as a good thing. It seems like we have gotten to a point in America where the owning class isn't even in a position to make concessions to the working class. They can't even offer us tiny things. Like, we can't even get healthcare reform. They can't even lower the price of insulin or something like that. Even something small that doesn't fit something like the gaping holes in our system, like privatized healthcare, they can't even put a patch on that anymore because the system has become so dysfunctional. And another part of the Marxist worldview that I think is really important is understanding the world through the lens of imperialism and anti-imperialism. Again, to reference like sort of the liberal worldview, liberals sort of imagine that the world is just as it is, and that's the natural order of things. The West is rich, and the entire global South is poor, and that's too bad, but the West is trying oh so hard to try to make those countries develop and not be poor anymore, and have beautiful Western institutions like good old-fashioned American democracy. But the Marxist worldview says there's a material reasons that the global inequality is like this, like why there is a wealthy West and a impoverished global South. And that's because of imperialism. It's a deliberate policy of Western countries to exploit the rest of the world. And these countries are not underdeveloped. They're not poor countries in the terms of natural resources. They have an abundant natural resources. They're simply overexploited by Western imperialist countries who take those natural resources through legalized extraction and intentionally keep those countries poor and make sure that when political leaders arise in those countries who say, this country is rich, like we have all these resources, and these resources should belong to us and make us rich instead of people thousands of miles away. And the way, whenever that happens, the Western imperialist countries say, get out of here. They flick them off. There's coups, there's invasions, there's all sorts of there's lawfare, like what happened in Brazil to Lula da Silva, who got accused of, I believe it was corruption on trumped up charges and thrown in jail to put the I think it's fair to say fascist Jair Bolsonaro in power, who went on to do all sort of reactionary things and burn the Amazon. And so I think understanding that there is an inherent contradiction between working people and owning people, and an inherent contradiction between countries that are victims of imperialism and imperialist countries, is the most important thing about the Marxist movement to me.
You know, to add on to Zach's point, there are the ruling class and then the working class. And so, what we need to understand is that there is always going to be a contradiction between what the working class and the ruling class wants. For example, the working class is always going to want to work the least amount of hours for the most amount of pay. In the case of the owning class, the CEOs, the people who are trying to extract profits from their laborers, they want workers to work the most amount of hours for the least amount of pay. This contradiction will always continue to exist, and there will be no way of truly compromising on this problem, because the reality is that the owners don't actually contribute to the material goods that they produce. It is the laborers who do that. And so, one way to mitigate during this transition period is unions, right? And so, that's why at the PSL, we definitely advocate for union labor, because it is the way that it's the, one of the only ways right now that workers can extract, can get some of their demands. But we do recognize that everyone sees these capitalist contradictions, right? As the price of products go up on grocery stores, it's impossible for working class families to shop. Why is that? It's because CEOs notice that it's called greedflation, where they can just increase their prices because they can. After COVID, you know, they were kind of given the full right to just change prices all they want. And so, because of that, working class people are suffering and are paying more for stuff that would have been way cheaper 5 years ago. And this is just the consistent outcome of this exploitative capitalism that we live in. And so, I think Marxist thought, it really grounds me. It helps me realize that there are no bad guys. We don't think that the CEOs or the billionaires are bad guys. They're doing what they're doing for material interests, right? Everyone is operating off of their own material desires, right? And so the liberal perspective would be just eat the rich and that's it. That's the kind of perspective, which is funny, maybe great on a shirt, but it doesn't address the real problems, which is that the ruling class and the capital owning class will always do what they need to do to gain more capital, right? And in fact, we can say, oh, well, if I was in that position, I wouldn't do that. Then you wouldn't be CEO, right? Like if you were CEO, you were actually a good person and you cared about your laborers, okay, then you would be removed by the board. Instead of thinking that there's good guys and there's bad guys, there's people that operate, everyone operates off of their own material interests. And so we need society to function in a way that favors the interests of the working class. And that's really what we're pushing for. And, you know, I think Zach and I would both recognize that Marxist thought and socialist thought has been condemned by the American government and really across all American institutions for a very, very long time. I would say even before the Cold War, there was already a war being declared like secretly in the back rooms of communism, right? But we believe that this is the only real counter to the destabilizing nature of capitalism. And we believe that it is up to the working class, because at some point they're going to have to decide, because it seems to us that the United States is moving towards fascism. Donald Trump, a lot of the policies that are being passed, even by Joe Biden, for example, this immigration bill that he has attempted to pass in the government, is completely super restrictive. It is literally a piece of legislation that, I mean, a fascist would pass. And it's because liberals are willing to collaborate with fascists when necessary. So the only real counter to fascism is socialism. And so we believe that even though the American government may not like that there are socialist organizations that are growing every day, we believe that when fascism is a threat, that socialism will be the only real counter to that.
Great. Thank you both for that. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about going back to your activism and organizing on campus, if you could tell us a little bit about what that has been like for you here. And I think the question is sort of, how do you want to engage your peers, faculty, staff, and what are the obstacles that come in the way of that?
You know, it's been a very interesting journey organizing at Emory specifically, because I think Zach and I are both aware, but this is a very, very Zionist institution. I mean, very, very, very pro-Israel. I mean, there are like several pro-Israel groups, organizations on campus. And so trying to like break into that narrative and say, no, that's not all there is actually, you know, like we're trying to establish that there are pro-Palestinian students on campus. Overall, if you were to poll anyone under the age of 35, they likely want a ceasefire. They likely have unpopular opinions towards Israel right now. And they think that Palestine deserves freedom. We wanted to have a space where we could finally organize around this issue that has been seen in such a contentious manner. It was definitely kind of a huge undertaking in the beginning, because we were like, do we have to self-censor a little bit? Like, in what way do we have to operate so that we don't get shut down? Because as we've seen in other universities that are also very prestigious, is that, you know, they've shut down their SJP chapters. They've shut down their, Jewish Voice for Peace chapters as well. So for us to operate as an organization that is unapologetically pro-Palestine was very difficult. We had to make a lot of decisions and be very strategic in our outreach. But I'm sure even Zach could probably talk to you about the type of backlash that we've received throughout our organizing, either like in person or having counter protesters at our actions. So Zach, if you're comfortable talking about that, that would be great.
Yeah, totally. To speak of obstacles, I think especially before this semester, there was a really strong like culture of sort of fear and harassment around Palestine organizing. The president of the university, Greg Fenves, he denounced a bunch of protesters who were actually at a Cop City protest, but had chanted pro-Palestine messages. He called all of them anti-Semitic for saying Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. But his email just said anti-Semitic phrases were chanted without going into detail about what people actually said. And sort of there's been this huge push for misinterpretation and sort of strawmanning pro-Palestine people to suggest that anything they say is anti-Semitic, anything they say is calling for violence against Jewish students. I believe the Emory Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is a club here on campus, even said that Students for Socialism saying, hey, hey, ho, ho, Zionists have got to go, is a call for violence against Jewish students, which I think is a little bit of an extra stretch there. But this is sort of what we're facing. I believe it's CARE Georgia, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations. They put together a report of a bunch of Muslim students and pro-Palestine students on campus who had complained to the university, and they were dissatisfied with the action the university had taken. And a lot of these reports that people are offering are very extreme. I believe there's more than one report of Muslim students who have been accused of being terrorists just for being Muslim. And afterwards, I think most of the people who said it were like, oh, I was just joking. But it's a very strange thing to joke about. It's a very cruel and sort of Islamophobic joke to make. I believe there's even an incident documented in there of a Muslim student who's sitting on like the Emory shuttle, sort of the bus, and behind them are two students, and they're referencing what their family in Israel said, and they said they've been saying kill them all on Palestinians, and then the other person they're sitting with laughs about this, and then the Muslim student reports it because they're extremely uncomfortable. Someone's just said to kill, they're advocating for genocide, and again the people who did it said, oh, we were just joking, oh, it was unserious. To my knowledge, I believe they actually got away with that. There's been, like, especially last semester and early this semester, there's been this like extremely rampant sort of culture of Islamophobia and administration signed off on harassment of pro-Palestine students. There's another instance in the report of students who are trying to chalk pro-Palestine messages, and a bunch of Zionist students come over and start harassing them. I know Students for Justice and Palestine Leadership took these complaints to one of the deans of the business school, and she said, well, if you're going to advocate for Palestine, you're already associating yourself with terrorism. And like, just the fact that the administration can say things like this, that they're allowing students to do things like this, is like really scary. And that's sort of like the culture that SFS has formed in, and sort of what we're trying to combat. After our first rally, I think a number of students came up to us and they were like, thank you for like making this statement. Thank you for standing up, because like, it's easy to think, to feel like really isolated, to feel like no one else is pro-Palestine, and just like you're stuck, surrounded by all these Zionists who have been empowered to harass you and do cruel things to you because you are pro-Palestine. What we're trying to do is we're sort of trying to bring students together and say, like, no, Emory is not a unanimously Zionist organization. Like, lots of us care about Palestine. Lots of us stand with Palestine, and like, we can get organized. We can stand together and we can speak out against this, and we can say to the Zionist counter-protesters who show up, like, there are 10 times more of us than you. We are organized in that way. And like, though we don't have the support of the administration to let us get away with harassment and doxing and all these things, and the administration to call the other side hateful for just expressing their opinions, we do have that organization. We have more student voices, and we have students who care. And I think that's what gives SFS strength in this culture of sort of hatred and harassment.
Sorry for interrupting. You aren't getting Zoom bombed.
I want that.
I was like, oh, this is important. Let me make sure I'm muted.
Okay, yeah, you want to introduce yourself?
I do equity and social justice work in schools in Southern Vermont. If you know where Vermont is. I didn't used to know where it was. I work with Anna and Spark and teacher as a teacher educator. And yeah, that's me. How y'all doing in Atlanta? You're rebel rousing out here.
Yeah, I'm doing great.
Rightfully so.
Good.
We need more of that.
Yeah, totally right. Michaela, I know you're just jumping in, but I want to make sure, since we do have you, if you have questions. We've covered a lot here. What we were just talking about is they're organizing on campus and the obstacles to that. Maybe I'll ask a question while you're just jumping in here if you have any questions. Okay. Because I know you of course are working with the larger PSL, and some of them showed up to the rally. One of the things I wanted to ask you about that rally was, did you both, I'm going to guess you both saw the coverage of it in the Emory Wheel. Did you see that? Okay. I also read that coverage, which I thought was quite disappointing as someone who attended the rally. And so what I want to give you both a chance, how would you cover that rally?
Oh, thank you. I mean, I've been meaning to talk about this, because first of all, there was already like an issue. I mean, this is like a nitpicking thing, but it is actually a big deal, because they were making it seem like only 50 people. I think in the first edition or the first like edit, they had put that like only 50 people were there. That was not true. It was almost like 95. It was a walkout, a rally, and a march. And we basically walked around the quad, and we made a stop at in front of the admin building where Zach was able to speak. And then we walked back to Asbury Circle, and then we kind of like wrapped up with some speakers and stuff. It was a really great, successful event. But yeah, it was really great. It was with Emory students of all like departments or like academic programs. Like there were undergrads, there were like grad students, there were like PhD students. It was a really successful event. We were really happy with how it turned out. And at first we weren't so much concerned about how Emory Wheel would cover it. We were actually concerned of just getting docs, because we had just started.
Sorry to interrupt real quick, but this is also, these fears also arose from the fact that the entire executive leadership of Students for Justice in Palestine had been doxed by an alumni over a protest that they didn't even organize, which was especially worrisome. I think it had been organized by Emory Stop Cop City, and then there were pro-Palestine chants there, and an alumni got so mad that he doxed the entire Students for Justice and Palestine leadership. And I believe that's yet another thing that the administration was completely silent on. They weren't willing to help those students at all.
Yeah, so that was our like main concern. So like, honestly, the way Emory Wood was going to cover it, we were like, they probably won't cover it well, honestly. Like we had like pretty low expectations. So like when the article came out, we weren't super surprised. They made it seem like there were more counter protesters than there actually were. And the fact that the counter protesters were in the article at all was kind of interesting, because they really had no agenda. The way it went down, there were like probably like 10 to 15 counter protesters, and they couldn't really do anything. They just kind of stood there and watched us. And so it was really weird to me how much of the article spent time on the counter protesters, because they really did not have like an organization backing them or anything. It was just a group of students that were like just there, you know. The way that the Emory Wheel has covered the Palestinian genocide, they cover it as if it's like a war, and they say Israel Hamas war or something, and I'm like, you're not CNN, you are a student organization. You guys have phones, you guys have Twitter, you guys have TikTok, you guys have Instagram. You can see that the ethnic cleansing is happening with your own eyes, but you don't want to deal with maybe admin getting mad at you that you cover it as a genocide, right? Obviously, we are anti-war. Let's be clear. We are anti-war, but we are also anti-genocide. And this is clearly a genocide. Like framing it as if it were a war is just very disingenuous, because it would seem that like both sides are equal and they're not.
To clarify a little bit, you spoke to it a little bit, and I don't know if your point has to do with this, Zach. Like, what do you say when people say like, we have to cover both sides? We have to acknowledge that there are two sides. Mm-hmm. Do you believe there are two sides? And what are your thoughts? And you said a little bit about it, Isabella, but go ahead.
Just to like establish a timeline, we had a rally early in the semester in late February. We had one about 2 weeks ago as well. Bella was mostly hearing me the first rally, and I want to talk about the second one a little. On the question of both two sides and both sides, I think basically every issue has multiple sides and perspectives on it. But I think anyone who says we need to look at all sides of the issue recognizes that there are sides that are too far and have opinions that are too hateful or just bad to ever acknowledge. For example, like if you were on CNN, they might say we need to acknowledge both sides of this, but they mean the Democrats and the Republicans. Like they wouldn't trot out like a white supremacist. They wouldn't trot out like Nick Fuentes or something like that to say, like, this is why I hate all non-white people. Because when you even in recognizing that there are multiple sides to a conflict, you recognize that some sides are too far, and I'm not going to recognize this side that is saying these things. And so I think there's something real when people say there are two sides to this, and there is a Zionist perspective. But as people who recognize this conflict as a genocide, we need to say, like, I don't think that people should be allowed to come out and say and speak in favor of a genocide. I don't think Americans should be able to say, yes, we should keep doing this genocide. There is a real perspective there. And I think as watching the film Israelism has really showed me, there's like a very, like, there's a very complex way that people who aren't evil individuals or cruel people or like sadists or something like this, they sort of are indoctrinated into this Zionist way of thinking. They're told it's bound to their identity, especially as Jewish people from a very young age. And so I don't think Zionists are evil people. I don't think they should be forcibly censored or something like that. But I think saying we need to look at both sides, you need to look at what the content of that other side is. And when the content of that other side is, I support a genocide. I want the continuation of the siege on Gaza. I explicitly oppose a ceasefire because I want this genocide to continue and go further. I think that is an opinion that media I agree with would not pay heedance to. They wouldn't say, we need to acknowledge this other side because of the content of what they're calling for. Yeah, and to add on to the question just about the media and the Wheels coverage, after that first rally, other than undercounting our numbers, which I think they later amended to say we're 75, while we accounted, I think, 92 near the end of the protest. It was an okay article that first time, but the second article they wrote about our second rally more recently was a lot more disappointing. Not only did they throw out most of their interview with Bella and sort of like just sort of sideline that, they had a huge part of this article where they quote the first half of one of the speaker's speeches, but not the second half. And if you only quote the first half of that speech, it looks like that person is antagonizing Zionists. It's the type of rhetoric that Zionist students will be quick to say, oh, that's anti-Semitic. They're calling for violence on campus or something like that. Because what they quoted in that Wheel article, they said, talking about the speaker who starts their speech by saying hi, enemies, and acknowledging the counter-protesters and talking about why there is an opposition between students who are pro-Palestine and students who are pro-Israel. And that's what made it into the article. But the second half of that speech says, but we don't have to be enemies, because while the Palestinian can only cease to be the enemy of the Zionist by giving up their homeland or dying, the Zionist need only renounce their views to become the ally of someone who is pro-Palestine. And the message was like, we are willing to talk to you. We want to work with you so that you can stop being Zionist, so that you can see why this conflict is a genocide, so that you can see the error in your ways and how a person who might otherwise be a good person, a friendly person, might have this view or be pro-Israel, even as horrible as the things that Israel is doing are. And so the real message was like, please, like, talk to us. Like, we welcome you into our camp. But what right into the Wheel was, you are our enemies. Like, you are our antagonists and we don't like you. Knowing that that writer of that article had been there for the whole rally and then heard that whole speech, I was very disappointed to see that that's only the first half could make it into the article without that second half.
If you don't mind, I want to add on to that, because part of the issue with that article, I had actually decided to interview with the reporter who wrote that article. I met with him before the rally had started, and he had asked me certain questions that I thought were great questions, very important. One of the main questions that he asked me that I want to give the answer to right now, because it was not written down, was he asked me, what is your political solution to the Israel-Palestine problem or conflict or whatever? And my answer to that question was, there needs to be one state where Israelis and Palestinians can live together. And he did include that part. He quoted that part, but he did not include how I added to that argument, which was, I brought it back to the United States of America, because not that long ago, the United States of America had segregated public schooling systems. There were Black schools and there were white schools, and they were segregated. right? And after Brown v. Board of Education, Brown v. Board of Education, as well as the civil rights struggle, the state had to like violently force people, like they had to bring in like the military to ensure to protect Black students from white parents who were angry that their students, their white students, had to be with Black students. This was a violent process. This was not an easy process. There are people who are still alive who had to deal with that process. Black women and men out there in America who had to deal with this process of integration. But it had to happen. Why? Because it was the right thing to do. In the same way, I'm not saying that a one state is going to be easy. It's not. It's going to be very difficult. In the same way that South African apartheid was difficult to end, so will this apartheid as well. But it is a necessary thing that needs to happen, in which the state needs to take control and ensure that there is no like violent outburst between the two populations and stuff. But it's the only way that peace can be achieved, because right now the two-state solution is something that has been thrown to the Palestinian people as a way of having hope that one day, you know, Israel will stop occupying their territory and taking over their land. And yet there has been no real material action taken from Israel to ensure that end. So in that case, the entire apartheid state needs to go away, and it needs to be one democratic state where Israelis and Palestinians can live together.
And just to add on to that about the two-state solution really quick, I wanted to say Israel has never tolerated two-state solution and is nowhere close to saying that's going to happen now. So a lot of people will say a one-state solution is unrealistic. It's never going to happen. But like, I think it's just as likely as a two-state solution. Zionists will sometimes say that they have offered Palestinians a state multiple times and they've always refused because they're just that intransigent. But if you look at the details of these deals, this so-called Palestinian state always does not include a military, no rights to their borders, no rights to their airspace, no rights to their water. So we're talking about very much like sort of a formalized negative peace where Israel retains like an incredibly strict control over Palestine while calling this a state without any of the trappings of the state, like a military or control over your natural resources or borders. Even today, Netanyahu is rejecting a two-state solution. And so when liberals sort of prop up this two-state solution as a more realistic, easier compromise to reach, I think what this ignores is the fact that Israel has been completely intransigent on the two-state solution. They've never given even an inch to this idea, like a true state in the conventional sense of the word, like that every other government would be described as, you know, a force that can exert itself, because Israel cannot have Palestinians having a military because it'll stop their military domination over.
Yeah. And I think like to bring it back to sort of the what you were both talking about with worldviews and like understanding, and I, because what I often think about is like my own principles, which is an end to empire and it's an end to imperialism. And imperialism, by definition of how I would define it, is continual economic expansion that is absolutely necessary to this type of political economy. I keep on thinking about how oftentimes you hear or you'll see these memes or whatever about like Palestine will free us all. I think that that's, they're linking it to like the end of like settler colonialism or end to like a violent capitalist system that enables this type of violence and brutality. I think that's why I was also asking about that question of like, how do your principles and analysis of the world help guide you to that right, the right side of history? Okay, I know also we're running out of time here, so I just want to end with maybe if you could both tell me maybe like your hopes, both at Emory and sort of like wider hopes, because you're also very much linked to things outside of Emory.
Yeah, what I hope for at Emory is like, I hope that a student movement can form that will outlast both me and Bella. I hope that students can remain organized, hopefully within SFS, but if it's with another organization, that's okay with me too. I hope that Emory students can just like stay in an organized fashion that can continuously oppose the administration's stances and fight for justice on campus, whether that be in Palestine, whether that be stopping Cop City, whether that be the struggle for any other thing that students feel is important. I think that Emory needs to stay organized, has to have a longevity to that organization, like something that could continually reproduce itself, that can continually draw in young students. And I think the absolute goal of that, something that my dream for Emory is that they divest from Israel, that they cut their ties with Israel and stop having exchange study abroad programs in Tel Aviv, that they stop funding the Gili program, which I don't think we have time to get into, but if you know about that, Emory's funding it. And off campus, pretty similar. I just hope that a genuine socialist and anti-imperialist movement can keep growing, can keep building steam, and get to a point where liberals cannot ignore us anymore, where they have to pay attention behind their left flank. Because at the moment, it just seems like because of like the incredibly effective campaign of shaming that has occurred in 2016 and 2020 on the left, the Democratic Party will always say, you support fascism if you're not going to vote for us. Hope that we can get to a point in the future, and I think like things like the Uncommitted campaign and the Claudia and Corita campaign are a step towards this, where the like power in America needs to mind the left. They need to recognize that if they just go and do whatever they want, if they keep moving to the right, then they're going to face consequences for that. They're going to get punished for that, because that's not what people want. That's my dream for Emory in America.
My dream for Emory is so that every student that notices the contradictions, notices how difficult it is to get a job, even though you've gone to one of the most prestigious universities, students who came to this country and came to this institution with the intention of staying in America and have difficulties finding companies that are willing to support them, that are willing to help them stay here. I'm thinking about students who are low income, to find the capacity to turn to Marxist thought, as well as organizing around those issues, organizing around tuition going up every single year, and the quality of education not necessarily improving, healthcare not being a guarantee, right? Not being affordable for the vast majority of people. Emory employees and workers and their conditions and their pay improving. This is about Emory students, but this is about the Emory community as a whole, right? Organizing around bettering conditions for themselves, and preparing themselves for when they go into the workforce, for when they move on to the next stage of their lives, that they have the tools to organize. That's really what I want. And ideally, you know, I would want people to continue or socialist organizing after that, either joining the party or joining other socialist organizations as well, and continue in that struggle. Because I think young people notice how expensive it is to live, how the U.S. just funds all these endless wars and none of it ever ends up with us. Student debt relief was not given, right? And so I think young people are frustrated. They need a place to use that frustration and make a change. And we're hoping that SFS is that home for people, that it's not just a place where change will happen, like divesting from Israel and all these sorts of policies, but as well as create a community around organizing. In the case of the United States of America, I think we need massive, massive social change. I think we need to depart from the two-party system that only benefits the ruling class. We need socialist mobilization, socialist organization. We need to be intentional and careful about the way that we operate in these spaces, of course. But it is very important work because, like I had mentioned earlier, socialism is the only real counter to fascism. The U.S. is on a fascist decline. The acts of terror that have been committed against LGBT people, that have been committed against women, or literally prosecuting women for getting abortions, for example. All of that is the symptoms of a dying empire. It's happening. It's on its way. And it is up to us to mobilize and increase class consciousness in the working class of this country, as well as let them know that fascism is not the answer. Oppressing immigrants is not the answer. Oppressing women is not the answer. Oppressing LGBT people is not the answer. Fighting for the working class, ending all of these wars, and really improving our conditions, as well as eventually doing a revolution. That is what needs to happen. That is what, you know, down the line needs to be the eventual solution to our problems. I don't know if I will live to see the day where that happens, where a revolution really comes, but I hope that the work that we have done has brought us even an inch closer to that.
Yeah, thanks for that. Oh, thank you so much. You two, really wonderful to talk to you and get your thoughts. I really, really appreciate your time on this. Thank you.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you so much for having us on.
That does it for our show. Again, this is Anna in Atlanta for Indigo Radio, and you are listening to Zach and Bella, current students at Emory University here in Atlanta. You can connect with them via Instagram at Students for Socialism at Emory on Instagram. We are going to include a couple show notes to different issues that they mentioned. Thanks for listening, everyone. Don't forget to subscribe on whatever podcast app you use, and we'll be back with another show. Thanks, everyone.
Que vivan los estudiantes, jardín de nuestra alegría. Son aves que no se asustan de animal ni policía, y no le asustan las balas ni el ladrar de la jauría. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva la astronomía. Me gustan los estudiantes que rugen como los vientos cuando le meten al oído sotanas y regimientos. Pajarillos libertarios igual que los elementos. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva lo experimento. Me gustan los estudiantes porque levantan el pecho cuando le dicen harina, sabiéndose que es afrecho. Y no hacen el sordo mudo cuando se presenta el hecho. Caramba y zamba la cosa, el código del derecho. Me gustan los estudiantes porque son la levadura del pan que saldrá del horno con toda su sabrosura. Para la boca del pobre que come con amargura. Caramba y zamba la cosa, viva la literatura. Me gustan los estudiantes que marchan sobre la ruina con las banderas en alto a toda la estudiantina. Son químicos y doctores, cirujanos y dentistas. Caramba y zamba la cosa, vivan los especialistas. Me gustan los estudiantes que con muy clara elocuencia a la bolsa negra sacra le bajo las indulgencias. Porque hasta cuando nos dura, señores, la penitencia. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva toda la ciencia. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva toda la ciencia.